This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For five trading days now, the global economic story has centered on one phrase: interest rates. They're going up, not just here, but all over the place. Central banks everywhere are making money more expensive. Today on the program, the trickle-down effects of a twitchy bond market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, June the 12th. Good to have you with us. Let me run a couple of other key words and phrases by you. Liquidity is a good one to start with. The global cash glut has gotten a lot of the credit for the run-up in the world stock markets of late. Tightening is another one. That's what's happening to interest rates right now. That supply of cash is getting tighter. And then there are the currency markets. Money itself is a commodity, you know. Add them all up, and what you get out the other side is a stock market that's not quite sure what's going on. We've got our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, here to tie it all together for us. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so as I said up at the beginning, it's been five long days now that there's been this dance between stocks and bonds. What's going on?
Okay, well, join me, if you will, Kai, in a chorus of you can't always get what you want.
That's right, yeah.
But sometimes you get what you need. Here's the deal. Stock market investors have been counting on the economy growing just enough for profits to be good, but they've also been hoping that inflation would stay low enough that the Federal Reserve might be persuaded to goose the economy with lower interest rates. Mm-hmm. Well, over the past week, Mr. Bernanke and company have been sending signals that, no, there's still a real threat from inflation here, and if anything, there might need to be an interest rate increase to keep pricing pressures under control. So what we're seeing from investors right now is that if they can't get what they want, they'll get what they need, and that would be decent returns for their money. Hey, if interest rates are going to go up after all, then a lot of investors seem to be saying, okay, let's put our money with those bonds that are increasing their yields right now.
Right.
I talked to University of Maryland economist Peter Morici about this today. He believes we're seeing a calculated move, literally a move on the part of a lot of investors.
It's a market timing issue. Some people try to time the market. They allocate their assets in hopes of maximizing their return in the long run by moving back and forth between stocks and bonds. Of course, you have to be very talented at picking the right time to buy and sell.
Now, he also says that the fact that interest rates are now widely believed to be headed higher, well, that's brought back another worry for a lot of investors, the dreaded unwinding of the carry trade. That caused a lot of nerves, you might recall, when we saw the stock market take that really big dive earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll be honest. You had me right up until you said that thing about carry trade. Remind us what that is and why it matters.
Okay, suppose that you go borrow a cheap currency like the yen. The interest rate's less than 0.5% over in Japan right now. So you borrow at that cheap interest rate, and then you convert that to dollars, and you invest it here where your return is going to be better, or over in, let's say, New Zealand, where the interest rate is now around
8%.
8%, right. Right. So that's essentially free money that you're getting from that. You're borrowing from the bank at a cheaper rate, and then you're investing at higher interest rates. You pocket the difference. But here's the rub. If U.S. interest rates go higher, and they start to push the value of the American greenback down, then all those people who borrowed the yen or other cheap currencies abroad are going to see their margins vanish, and they're going to have to pay that all back. Mm-hmm. And Peter Morici, the University of Maryland economist, says that's one of the things that's feeding into the volatile investing climate that we've been seeing develop over the last few days.
The people that are gambling in the carry trade are gambling against a fall in the dollar. At some point, that has to unwind. And some people are starting to get skittish about it right now.
So you can get really nailed if you're investing in a currency that right away falls.
Mm-hmm.
The carry trade can be very lucrative, but I've seen it compared to trying to snatch pennies in front of an oncoming steamroller.
Let me ask you very quickly now. We've got about 15 seconds. When eventually are people going to stop paying attention to this bond stock thing and just go about the way business has been happening for the past several years on Wall Street?
Well, I've heard it said that there's still a lot of cash floating around out there.
Right, so, liquidity. Right.
Liquidity. And that this may not develop into anything big, that it's a section of the economy, but it's really just a niche.
All right. Bob Moon is our senior business correspondent. We call him that because he gets the tough stories. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Guy.
All right. Now that we've spent 3 minutes telling you why the markets are doing what they're doing, here's what happened today. More of the same. Investors kept one eye on the bond market, the other on corporate profits. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As you might have gotten from Bob a minute ago, the bond market can be a tricky place. It's just as volatile as stocks and tougher to figure out sometimes, like why do bond prices fall when yields rise? If you're comfortable in that arena and answering a question like that, buying bonds might be for you. Regulators have tightened their disclosure rules. Brokerages have been dropping their fees, too. Charles Schwab is the latest, as Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Starting this summer, Charles Schwab will charge customers $1 per online bond trade, on average less than customers used to pay. The company will also start to break out prices so investors know how much commission they're paying. The changes follow similar moves at other brokerages. Investment advisor Gary Schilling says Schwab and others want to corner the growing bond market.
I think they sense that people are a little nervous with stocks. They might be more interested in bonds. Therefore, there may be potentially a greater market than there was before.
While some people think bonds are complicated, Schilling says they're a lot more straightforward than stocks or emerging markets. But until a few years ago, bond trade prices weren't even reported to the public. So paying the right price for a bond if you weren't a broker was hard to do. USC professor Larry Hughes says brokerage price changes wouldn't matter so much if bond prices were still opaque.
What came first was the technologies that allowed direct access through the internet. And what also came first was the regulations that now require that these prices be reported with a 15-minute lag.
Now investors can go online to see how much bonds are fetching.
But you know what? People don't do it.
That's Marilyn Cohen with Envision Capital Management.
People will cut out coupons and drive all over town to save $50 on a color TV, but they won't go online to check that bid and ask spread.
Cohen says any bond investor should do that online price check, or they could get ripped off. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Scottie Pippen spent 17 years playing professional basketball to the tune of millions of dollars a year. Lee Bass made his billions in the Texas oil fields. Paul Allen is number 6 on the Forbes list of the world's richest people. And yet each of them got checks from the Federal Farm Subsidy Program last year. A report out today from the nonprofit Environmental Working Group tracks billions of dollars in subsidies for the past 3 years. And Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the disclosures are already affecting debate over the next farm bill.
No one in America is supposed to receive more than $360,000 a year in farm subsidies. But that didn't stop Maurice Wilder from netting more than $1.8 million in 2005 alone. And the thing is, Wilder doesn't need the cash. Ken Cook is president of the Environmental Working Group.
Why on earth are we making payments in the name of saving the family farm to someone who's worth $400 or $500 million?
Today, Cook's group unveiled a new online database that for the first time fully reveals all the people who benefit from the farm subsidy program.
Maurice Wilder is the largest individual beneficiary of farm subsidy programs in the last 3 years.
Since 2003, the feds paid Wilder more than $3.3 million in farm subsidies. Cook would like Congress to close the loopholes that made that possible and impose a strict means test that would prevent folks who make more than $250,000 a year from receiving any subsidy. Lobbyist and former chair of the House Ag Committee, Charlie Stenholm.
It would be naive on the part of anyone to believe that we're going to maintain the status quo regarding subsidies, who gets them, how they're paid, and how they fit into the overall agricultural policy of our country.
Pressure's mounting to trim farm subsidies, but Stenholm doesn't want to end subsidies altogether. And he's leery of strict means testing that he says could hurt real farmers and make food more expensive for consumers. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Everybody's heard of social networking sites by now, right? Websites like MySpace and Facebook that connect people who have similar interests. More and more of those sites are in Spanish, hoping to tap into what could be a huge market, which could mean competition for English language sites chasing limited advertising dollars. Ambar Espinoza reports.
Back in the 90s, a company called Community Connect was a pioneer in the field when it launched two social networking sites, Asian Avenues and Black Planet. In 2000, it added Mi Gente, an English-language social networking site aimed at Latinos. Black Planet and Mi Gente are among the top 20 such sites globally, according to the research site Hitwise.com. The creators of these new Spanish-language sites say they offer something the mainstream counterparts don't. Damian Pelumio is founder of ElHood.com.
You know, I just came from Spain, and there's so many amazing artists over there that you will never, ever find in the U.S. because the industry is not prepared to promote those artists here in the U.S. So you go to our site, and you will find them, and you will enjoy them.
Belumio says the people who work on the site come from many countries in Latin America, reflecting the audience they serve. Daniel Keefe is a co-founder of Vostu.com, which connects students in Latin America and Latinos here in the U.S. He says MySpace's Spanish language version is basically just a translation of its English site.
It's not the same thing as what we're trying to do, which is creating a network from scratch and saying these are the features that we think Latin Americans could really use because it's aligned with their culture.
And that's a big selling point to advertisers. Research shows Latino online users tend to be more affluent, more educated, more Americanized than the overall Latino population in the U.S. And on average, they're 10 years younger than the general online market. Lee Van is founder and CEO of a Hispanic marketing firm called Captura Group. Van says there are more than 16 million Latinos online. It's the fastest growing segment of internet users, rapidly outpacing the mainstream market.
The U.S. market is growing at about 1%, whereas the Hispanic market is growing at about 15% each year.
Van says $16 billion a year is spent on internet advertising in the U.S. Only 150 million of that targets Latinos. But more users could mean more ad revenues. Some estimate the use of social networking sites by U.S. Latinos tripled last year. On top of that, the sites are appealing more and more to the 60 million web users in Latin America. And online ad spending in the region is also up. The entrepreneurs behind the new Spanish-language social networking sites are counting on a powerful source to attract users, word of mouth. It's how Claudia Pineda, a college student in Los Angeles, got drawn in.
To be honest, like, I just got on MySpace because everyone else had one, and I was like, what's the big buzz about it, you know?
Pineda isn't convinced the Spanish-language sites will pull her away from MySpace, but online experts like Lee Van say things may change. If the new sites offer content that really hits home with Latinos, profiles of athletes like Diego Maradona or pop artists like Shakira, they could hit it big. If they can gain a critical mass of users, then maybe some of the bigger online players in the Latino market, like Univision or Telemundo, could buy them out. In Los Angeles, I'm Ambar Espinosa for Marketplace.
Coming up, regulating the adult industry can be a touchy business.
If you think it proper that they should be groped and fondled by the patrons, then go ahead and vote no.
But first, let's do the numbers. As we mentioned up top, investors marched to the beat of the bond market again today, and the stock market tripped over the baton. The Dow Industrials tumbled 129 points, just shy of 1%, to finish at 13,295. The Nasdaq shed 22 points, 0.8%, ended the day at 2549. The S&P 500 fell 16 points, more than 1%, wrapped up the day at 1493. The rout was pretty much across the board today. AT&T dropped 2.5%. Stock in JPMorgan Chase lost more than 2%. Walmart shares were down 1.8%. Lehman Brothers was able to buck the trend. Its shares gained 0.5% after it beat expectations with a 27% jump in profits. Shares of Dean Food sliced off 4.25%. Rising milk prices are hurting sales there. Bond prices fell again, as we mentioned, sending the yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to its highest level in 5 years, 5.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for May. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book survey of regional economic conditions. And the largest ever collection of artist Frida Kahlo's paintings is scheduled to go on exhibit in Mexico City. The event commemorates her upcoming 100th birthday next month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Ford says it's a strategic review of its global operations. Analysts are saying it's about time. The struggling carmaker announced today it's hired bankers to help figure out how to sell off Land Rover and Jaguar. Micheline Maynard covers Detroit for the New York Times. Mickey, good to talk to you again.
Hello, Kai.
What's the business rationale here for Alan Mulally, the CEO of the company?
Well, Mr. Mulally, the former Boeing executive, came into Ford about October of last fall, and I think he's taken some time to look over the company, but come to the conclusion that Ford's core business, its operations in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, are really the most important thing. Those have to be fixed, especially the North American operations. And so it's been very nice for Ford to have these glamorous brands like Jaguar, Aston Martin, and Land Rover, but these days you really have to trade glamour for reality.
Is that glamour making them any money? I mean, the Jaguar and Rover bringing any cash for them?
You know, they put together what was called the Premier Automotive Group, and for a few years it actually made money. And at one time, Ford thought that this group, which included Volvo as well, could contribute a couple of billion dollars a year to the bottom line. But last year, Premier Automotive Group lost about $325 million. And it's been very clear that these are the kinds of brands that require a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars, management attention. These are globally identifiable brands. And you know, Ford's really had kind of a strategy of stop and start when it's come to these companies.
Was this going to be one of those, we'll share platforms and components and cut down on supply costs? I mean, was that the root cause of this deal?
Well, I think that is exactly what they tried to do with Jaguar. They've used some Ford platforms for Jaguar vehicles, which just horrified the Jaguar purists, the people who remember Jaguar in the 1950s and 1960s and remember when it was a really hot swinging car during the 1960s. You know, Ford was looking at what everybody's looking at, which is mainly Toyota, which is able to take the platform for a vehicle, the underpinnings of a vehicle, and turn it into five or six or seven different kinds of cars. Well, that's really hard to do when you're talking about these fabled luxury brands. They essentially are what they are.
Yeah, and somehow a Jag's not a Jag if it's on a Ford chassis, right?
Well, there are a lot of people that felt that way, and Jaguar has just continued to lose money. There have been several turnaround efforts. And remember that Ford paid a lot of money for Jaguar. They actually estimated back in 1990 that the company itself was worth about $500 million, but the purchase price was $2.5 billion, and they basically paid a $2 billion premium to get the Jaguar name. It has never paid them back that investment.
You know, the last big car deal we had was Daimler-Chrysler basically giving Chrysler away to Cerberus, a private equity group. Who is it that's going to buy Land Rover and Jaguar? Is it going to go private equity?
Well, I think private equity will be the sort of number one suspect here again. Land Rover ought to bring them in some income. They made $925 million selling Aston Martin earlier this year, and Land Rover could be valuable to somebody. Now, BMW probably won't be a candidate since they sold Land Rover to Ford in the year 2000, but there could be another European automaker who's interested.
All right, Mickey, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
Micheline Maynard is the Detroit Bureau Chief for The New York Times. There's more going on in the Senate this week than just mopping up the aftermath of the immigration bill. The upper chamber has started work on an enormous energy plan. It would require wider use of biofuels. It would create tough penalties for price gouging and set new fuel economy standards, too. Commentator Ben Stein says he's all for a sound energy policy, but he says fuel standards aren't the way to do it.
Supposedly, in the Old West, the Colt revolver was the great equalizer. It meant that a small man had just as much chance of winning a fight as a large man. My own feeling is that in the modern world, the great equalizer is the potent combination of the automobile and gasoline. With the car and truck in mass production, and gasoline, of course, the ordinary Joe six-pack in his SUV can take up as much space on the highway as the billionaire with his Ferrari or his Prius. Joe six-pack can go almost as fast. He can often pass up the millionaire's daughter in her hybrid with his pathetic old blazer. Now, the beautiful people in their Priuses and Ferraris are in revolt against the ordinary guy in his SUV or his Cadillac. In the face of global warming, the powers that be are demanding that car makers make their cars smaller and lighter so that they burn a lot less gasoline. It will become far more difficult and expensive for the ordinary schmo to drive a big car if Congress, now the tool of the environmentalist beautiful people, and God bless them, of course, raises the corporate average fuel efficiency ratings of new cars and trucks. Now, don't get me wrong. I want to fix the environment and conserve resources and make us energy independent as much as the next guy. But what I wonder is this. Why don't we start on this by having a ban on the private jets and yachts my tree-hugging rich pals out here in Hollywood love so much? Why can Congress make it hard for the middle class to drive the cars they love and at the same time do nothing about moguls burning thousands of gallons an hour in their Gulf Streams or Lursen yachts? If we're going to stop our addiction to fossil fuels and clean the air, shouldn't the really rich play their part too? I guess the answer is simple, as George Orwell gave it to us long ago. We're all equal, but some are more equal than others.
Ben Stein is a writer, an actor, and a lawyer. Take a minute to send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. There are very few unvarnished economic truths out there. Rising prices aren't always a bad thing. In the corporate world, there is such a thing as having too much money. And sometimes, creating new jobs is a problem, especially if some consider those jobs sleazy. The state legislature in Ohio has tough new rules regulating strip clubs and adult video stores. Club owners say their businesses are being threatened, and they're trying to take the issue straight to the voters this fall. From Ohio Public Radio, Bill Cohen reports. One quick thought before we get started. This might not be a story for the kids to hear.
At the Cahoots Club in Columbus, the music throbs and the lights are low. Bare-breasted women undulate just inches from adoring customers who slip money into the dancers' G-strings. It's the kind of scene that makes the group Citizens for Community Values see red. The conservative groups as X-rated bars, bookstores, and video outlets are dens of iniquity with a big cost. David Miller helps lead the group.
The increase in crime that it brings to neighborhoods, lower property values, it brings an urban blight and a general downgrading to those areas of the community.
To blunt the blight, Citizens for Community Values successfully pressured Ohio into passing a statewide crackdown. It bans naked dancing between midnight and 6 a.m. It also says if patrons touch dancers, it could mean 6 months in jail. Here is State Representative Bill Seitz on the House floor.
And if you think that the young ladies who are working their way through college, supporting their children while dancing for the patrons' entertainment, if you think it proper that they should be groped and fondled by the patrons, then go ahead and vote no.
But many of the dancers say they don't need protection. Dozens have shown up at the Capitol. Dancer Amber Lehman says they are independent contractors renting space at the clubs, and their pay depends on patrons getting up close and personal.
When we do a dance, our tips are what pay us, and if they can't pay us, then we'll all be out of work.
Club owners say the late-night shutdown of new dancing would slash their profits because 70% of their business doesn't come in until after midnight. Former stripper Angelina Spencer, the head of a national group of club owners, claims 10,000 industry jobs and a lot of cash are at stake in Ohio.
Look, everyone wants to say only perverts and geeks patronize those clubs. The industry is not a $250 million per year industry in the state of Ohio because 250 guys in raincoats are spending $1 million a year.
The group Citizens for Community Values says strip club profits might dip, but not enough to force shutdowns. Eight other states have some kind of statewide limits on X-rated businesses. In Nashville, Tennessee, a 3-foot buffer zone is required between dancers and customers. Club owner Joe Hall claims that has slashed his bottom line.
My gross dollar revenues went down 65%, and they have never recovered.
Ohio club owners have been threatening to sue over the new limits. They've also launched a petition drive to try to block the new law from taking effect in September. If successful, the drive will also give voters the final say on whether the law is good or bad. What do Ohioans think about all this? A critic of the crackdown, State Representative Dan Stewart, has this take.
The thing I hear most from the public is, this is a stupid bill. Aren't there more important things you guys need to be dealing with down there than this?
Actually, a recent poll shows voters split right down the middle on the state regulating strip clubs. But there's a gender gap. Only 36% of men favor a new law, but 53% of women like the idea. In Columbus, I'm Bill Cohen for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today foreclosures seem to be the only part of the real estate market that's booming. RealtyTrack was out with its May report today. Nationwide, the number of foreclosure filings was up 19% from April, up 90% from May of 2006. Mostly, it's part of the subprime fallout, but take a look around your neighborhood. The company says one out of every 650 homes in this country was foreclosed on last month. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow tanked 129 points. We'll call that 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 22 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 lost 16 points, also 1% there. Let's do bonds here just for the heck of it. The yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note stands at 5.29% this afternoon. That's above the Fed's own short-term rate, 5.25% on the federal funds rate. Thanks to Miguel Macias and Doug Krisner, Rita Jablonski as well on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report was produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, helping farm workers reap some rewards.
It's an American dream
to get a piece of land is not easy. It's hard because the loans now is difficult to get.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.